Paul, thank you so much for joining us. He's also a professor at Princeton, a columnist for the New York Times. He won the Nobel Prize for his work on global trade patterns. You know, I noticed in your background from 1982 to 83, you worked at the Reagan White House as a staff member on the Council of Economic Advisors. Kind of a surprise to hear that about someone who writes a blog called Conscience of a Liberal.
Yeah, so it was a non-political position. It was just below. I was the senior staff member for international, senior staff member for domestic. What was his name? Summers, Larry Summers. Don't know what happened, ever happened to him. So a couple of Democrats there doing, but you know, it was a technical job. It was fun. It was actually, among other things, it removed any lingering notion I had that people in Washington actually knew what they were doing.
Ezra Klein wrote that Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank, and also Germany's Angela Merkel are going to be the key to decide who America's next president is. Do you agree with that?
Well, I actually think that it's getting a little late for that to be decisive. I mean, it's true that a total blow-up in Europe can really hurt us badly, although I'm not even sure how that would play politically. Will people actually blame Barack Obama if the Europeans muck up, or will they say, well, you know, at least we're doing – I don't know how that plays politically. You know, I think a lot of this is domestic. The U.S. economy is kind of – it's doing badly but not catastrophically, and that's a zone in which basically who knows how the election goes. I don't really – I think it's too much to say that the Europeans are going to decide it. A lot of other things are going to decide this election.
What lessons should we draw in the United States from the way that European nations have handled these economic problems?
Okay, so the Europeans have one – they made one big mistake that we have not, which was they had a single currency without a single country. It really helps to have a common government. And so – but we sort of solved that problem 150 years ago with the Civil War. So that's not our issue. But what we've had is an object lesson. Anybody who said that, oh, it's good if the government cuts spending even when the economy is depressed because that will improve confidence and the private sector will create jobs, well, just look at what's happening. That's not how it's worked. And I like to actually point to Ireland. Greece is one story, and Greece has a lot of irresponsibility. The Irish have been good soldiers. They've done everything they were supposed to do. They did their austerity early and often. They've tried their best to balance the budget. They bailed out their banks the way they were supposed to. And what they've gotten for it is 15% unemployment, 30% youth unemployment. Nothing has worked. And that's telling us that the people who say, well, what we need to do here in our own version of this depression is that what we need to do is slash government spending. They're just asking that we have – that we reproduce everything that's going wrong in Europe.
And you take a very different approach in the new book. It's called End This Depression Now. My guest, Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winning economist. Now, first of all, End This Depression Now. A depression is a downturn in economic activity. Haven't we seen some growth? Isn't there some moderate growth going on? Why do you call it a depression?
No, actually, a recession is a downturn. A recession is when things are heading down. A depression is when things are down. So, you know, what we call the Great Depression is a stretch of more than a decade, which includes two big recessions and two not so big recoveries. So there were times when the economy was growing. 1935, the U.S. economy was actually growing at a fairly rapid clip, but it was still very much in the Great Depression because unemployment was very high. And that's kind of where we've been. The official recession ended in June 2009, but the growth has never been enough to get us anywhere close to an acceptable level of employment. Now, it's not as bad as the Great Depression. Been thinking, well, maybe that should be Obama's election slogan, right? Not as bad as the Great Depression. Because it could have been, and you know, give the other guy a chance, and it might be. The point is this extended long period. And remember, we're now in year five of this, of high unemployment, disastrous environment, terrible, you know, people who've been out of work for 4 million people who've been out of work for more than a year. That hasn't happened since the 30s. Young people who come out of college and can't find jobs, or if they can find jobs, they're trying to pay their student debts while working as a barista at Starbucks. I mean, this is a terrible situation, and that's a depression.
Before we get to your solutions, let's talk about a little bit more about where we are. As if the European crisis wasn't enough, the Congressional Budget Office says that the tax hikes and spending hikes set to take effect in January unless Congress acts could throw us back into a recession. How are these factors going to affect the economy?
Well, whatever we're calling it, the fiscal cliff at the end of the year. This is going to be a problem because it's basically a game of blackmail. And in effect, we've got the Republican Party saying, you know, give us everything we want or we'll shoot your dog. And which also happens to be our dog, too. So basically, we'll destroy the whole economy for and I think at this point, they've already pulled this trick once and gotten a lot of what they wanted. And I think the president, if he is reelected, has to say, no, this is we make a deal which in which both sides give or this happens and let those Wall Street people who've been giving you all this money, let them yank your chain and say we can't accept this. But it's not really an economic problem. It's not at all hard to deal with this, but it's a political problem.
It's something needs to get done though, right? I mean, if right. both sides just have a standoff, this happens with bad results.
It happens and then we get a chance to reverse policy. You know, I think there comes a point when you have to say put up or shut up. It cannot always be the responsibility of the president to avoid catastrophe and always the ability of the Republicans to say, you know, we're gonna blow up this place if we don't get everything we want. So that's a tough. I mean, but it's not really about economics. We know what to do. It's just about whether we can reach any kind of political agreement. And if not, we go to the crisis and then work from there. J.P. Morgan,
yeah,
it's great. I mean, I'm very thankful to Jamie Dimon because J.P. Morgan has been leading the charge against financial regulation on the basis that they were the responsible bank. They know what they're doing. Jamie Dimon stayed out of subprime, didn't get involved. And so he's been the perfect spokesman for Wall Street saying, oh, you know, trust us. We never did anything wrong, and furthermore, we won't do it again. And now we find out that, what do you know, J.P. Morgan has been doing highly risky investments essentially with taxpayer-backed funds because they are a too-big-to-fail bank with federally guaranteed deposits. So they've basically been gambling with taxpayers' money. And what's more, they've actually been doing exactly the same kinds of investments that got us into the crisis in the first place. Hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, but it turns out that J.P. Morgan has bought about 45% of the mortgage-backed securities issued in Britain in the last 3 years. Mortgage-backed securities. Have we heard about that before? I mean, it's one thing to think that they might make new mistakes comparable to the mistakes that got us into the crisis. But the fact that they're making the exact same mistakes, that's awesome.
Is that winning any supporters though for financial regulations? I haven't noticed any, but are you? Is this really changing minds when it comes to lawmakers?
You know, there are not a whole lot of people who have changeable minds. Essentially, nobody on the Republican side of the aisle has a changeable mind. They already signed that contract in blood that says that they don't change their minds, so they can't be moved. But it has certainly changed the atmosphere, and I think it may actually change a little bit the outcome of the election and make it a little bit more likely that we manage to proceed with some regulation.
Your big idea in how to end this depression now is that the solution isn't that hard. You say that a couple times in the book. It's federal spending to jumpstart the economy. How much federal spending?
At this point, it doesn't take as much as it would have 3 years ago, right? So we are back a little bit. We're not in – the economy is not in free fall. I argue there that the thing you can do right away is aid to state and local governments so that they can reverse the big cuts they've already done. So we're not actually even really talking about new spending. We're talking about undoing the severe spending cuts of the last several years. And that would take around $300 billion a year to be maintained until the economy is strong enough that it doesn't need that support anymore, which would be we'll know that when we see it. So these are, you know, is that a lot of money? Not in a $15 trillion economy. It's not, actually. This is something we can do quite easily. And it would be, you know, right there. You would have more than a million jobs created directly just by rehiring school teachers, firefighters, police officers, and a large number of additional jobs created indirectly because of increased spending. Unemployment rate would drop to something like 6.5% fairly quickly. So, yeah, we can get – it's easy. Technically, economically, it's really easy. Politically, yeah. Obviously not. But that's a – you know, that's – politics.
Would that be the entire price tag, $300 billion going back to the states? Would that do it?
It would get us a long way. It would be – and it's not going to be just 1 year, so it would be more than $300 billion. It would be an amount to be determined depending on how long this goes on. But you have to bear in mind, again, the size of the U.S. economy, right? We've got a $15 trillion economy each year. We have a federal government that's able to borrow at interest rates well under 2% long term. So this is not actually an outlandishly expensive policy.
Paul Krugman is my guest. The book is called End This Depression Now. What's the track record of governments doing spending at this level and getting an impact out of it?
Big stimulus programs don't happen a lot in history, mostly because depressions are rare, which is when you want them and you need them, and because the same kind of political gridlock that we're seeing doesn't happen too much. We do have the track record of wartime spending. World War II, you know, it wasn't billed as a stimulus program, but it acted as one. It was highly successful. And we have the reverse. We see what spending cuts do, because we have lots of examples of austerity under depression conditions, and they are uniformly disastrous. It's, if you have the question about does government spending create jobs, well, we know that slashing government spending in a depressed economy destroys jobs. That's, you know, and the Europeans are giving us that lesson in spades right now.
But does that necessarily mean the opposite of that is true? I mean, we did do a big stimulus program at the beginning of this latest upheaval.
Actually,
can we point it straight?
We had a program that had a big headline price tag, although not that big. Again, $800 billion over 3 years in an economy that is going to produce $45 trillion worth of goods and services over that period is not such a big deal. 40% of that was tax cuts. A lot of the rest was aid to state and local governments, which was just about preventing cuts or delaying cuts rather than new stuff. The actual, you know, there was no WPA program there, right? There were no look for infrastructure spending from that plan, and it's there, but it's not that easy to see. It's little signs here and there saying this bit of road work was paid for by the Recovery Act. So we did not do a big stimulus program, and it was. And this is not hindsight. At the time, the people who read my column will know that I was tearing my hair out, saying this is way inadequate to the scale of the crisis we're in. And what's going to happen is people are going to say, oh, stimulus failed, when the fact is it was never really tried.
But it's going to come from borrowing. And we know in our personal lives, if we borrow too much, we'll be foreclosed upon. Businesses fail from borrowing too much. We see European nations kind of failing because, in part, they borrowed too much. Is the United States too big to fail?
Okay. A couple of things that you need to understand here. The first is, what is the nature of the crisis we're in? We are in a crisis that actually is brought in large part by debt, not government debt. Greece is a total exception here. But everywhere else, including Europe and certainly here, it's actually private debt. What actually happened was that bankers ran wild, made big loans, households ran up big debts. We had a housing bubble, they ran up big mortgage debts. And then we reached a point at which everybody sort of looked around. Actually, we talk about the Wile E. Coyote moment, right? You run off the cliff and then you look down, and it's only when you look down that you go and you fall. When people said, oh, that's too much debt, and everyone started trying or being forced to pay down debt at the same time. Which is disastrous because the economy is not a single family. The economy is, you know, an interlinked set of different players. And if everyone tries to spend less at the same time, well, your spending is my income and my spending is your income. So the result is a depression, and the debt problems actually get worse. Somebody has to step in and spend while everyone else is trying to cut back, which is why we need the government to do it. And the U.S. government is nowhere close to being in deep debt problems. I don't want it to run deficits forever, but now is the time to do it.
I wanted to get back to this, your big idea in this book, which is that the federal government really needs to put money into the economy in order to bring us out of this depression. And does that translate to the state level? In our state, there was discuss of borrowing for a program to create jobs. Does it make sense at the state level?
Very limited. For one thing, there are constitutional limits in most states to deficit financing. But also a state is state spends money. A lot of it spills over to other states, so it doesn't work the same way as with the federal government. There's just a lot less room for maneuver. And, of course, states don't have their own currency. It matters a great deal. One of the reasons that the U.S. government is pretty much immune from anything like what's happening to Greece is that we do actually borrow in our own currency. The state of Washington is more like Greece, which borrows in someone else's currency, the euro, the dollar. So, no, there's only so much. There's a little bit of wiggle room at the level of states, but not a lot. This has to be a national policy.
So if you're a state lawmaker and a bill is being proposed for $1 billion that will be borrowed and bonded to pay for these things, how do you look at that? How do you decide whether that's the right way to do it?
If it's valuable infrastructure, yes. I mean, this is actually a very good time for infrastructure spending. Interest rates are low. The workers that you'll employ are workers who would otherwise be unemployed. That's why actually I'm so angry at my governor. Governor yells at people of New Jersey who canceled the most important, you know, current infrastructure project in America, which is that second rail tunnel under the Hudson, for no good reason. He could have afforded it. The bonds could have been issued. Much of the money was coming from the federal government. So things like that, where there is some wiggle room, you should use it. But it is limited.
Like it or not, both Republicans and Democrats talk a lot about the deficit and how we're going to deal with the deficit. It's kind of the conversation is turned there rather than to spending programs of the sort that you suggest. And one of the things they'll bring up is we're just leaving this huge debt burden for future generations.
Okay. First of all, if we're really worried about future generations, how about all of those recent college graduates who can't find jobs? And we actually have a lot of evidence on how long will their careers, how long will their income suffer from the fact that they graduated into a lousy labor market? And the answer is forever. They will never recover. That we know that from past recessions. So if you really care about the future generations, how about, you know, providing an environment in which today's graduates can actually find jobs? How about providing infrastructure so that the next generation isn't going to be dealing with crumbling bridges and roads? And then if you actually try to work through the arithmetic, does austerity policies, does slashing spending now, does it even help the future budget? And the answer almost certainly is not, because it depresses the economy now, which means lower revenue. So a lot of what you save by slashing spending, you end up losing through lower tax receipts. Plus, it damages the economy in the long run. There's a lot of evidence that a depressed economy doesn't just hurt you now. It actually cuts into your future capacity. Those workers, we have 4 million Americans who've been out of work for more than a year. Many of them will never find jobs again. The longer that goes on, the more of them will never find jobs again. Those students will never be in get their careers back on track. Those are the future taxpayers of America. So even in a purely debt fiscal sense, it is disastrous to be doing this kind of austerity now. We have become like medieval doctors who treated patients. They thought that the way to treat a sick guy was to bleed him. And after the bloodletting, the guy would get sicker, and they said, well, we need to bleed him even more. And our deficit obsession right now is the same kind of thing. We're saying deficits, well, we have to cut, and then the deficits don't improve because the economy shrinks. So we need to cut even more.